In medieval Europe, power was organized by estates. An estate was a corporation, a body, which represented a particular powerful class in society. Originally, there were two estates, the landed nobility and the higher levels of the clergy. With the emergence of urbanization, the city, and of commerce, a third estate came into being, which represented the interests of the senior members of the guilds and of the new financial and merchant classes. And these estates met to inform the king of the interests of their particular class and to negotiate with members of the other estates when there were concerns which intruded upon the interests of the several classes. The Etats Généraux, the general meeting of these estates, continued in France, for instance, until the French Revolution, when a new form of representation by citizenship, by popular vote, took the place of this older form of corporate representation. We still have a vestigial record of this older form in the British Parliament, with this division into a House of Lords and a House of the Commons, House of the non-noble classes. The word for the press, which we hear so often, the fourth estate, was coined during the middle of the 19th century in Europe, long after government by corporation had ceased to be the norm. But it was a fit description, and so it became a popular one. It represents the truth that the press, what we would call today the media, is in fact an integral and essential element in the political system, and that the press, the media, has its own corporate group interests, which are not necessarily the same as those of other parts of the body politic, and which in the case of the media derive in part from authority outside of the political system. It's important to recognize that inevitably the press is involved in all of the tensions and the stresses and the arguments of political life, because its function to inform is obviously a major element in that of political debate. But whereas those who legislate and those who administer are elected popularly and can be recalled at the next election, the fourth estate is not subject to popular election or popular recall. It is employed by senior managers who represent the interests of those who own the television outlets, who own the newspaper presses, and these people have interests which are not necessarily those of any element in the body politic. Now, in the first instance, this is a great plus. It makes for a certain independence, both of the tidal movements of the popular will and of the determined exertion of authority by those who control the levers of power. It also, however, makes for the simplicity, for the sensationalism, which tends to dominate in many of the outlets of the media. For those who own these outlets, whether they be the presses or the television stations or the radio stations, require a mass audience in order to have the right kind of return on their investments, in order that they can sell advertisements, in order that they can get the kind of ratings that they require to be able to get the kind of income from the ads on television which they show. And of course, they then tend to produce what I call least common denominator news. That is, news which tends to emphasize the simple over the complex, the sensational over the substantial, which tends to reduce a very complicated political event to to a line or two, an image or two, which can be presumably readily comprehended, or to a human interest story, which is somehow part of the larger picture, but really does not illuminate, does not inform us as to the issues that are involved. And so the press tends to deal in the headline, in the sensational, in the simplistic, in that which can be quickly imaged. And insofar as it does so, it fails to provide the kind of deep political background, real information, which is necessary in any free society if the public is to be informed. Now, the press can readily say we're only presenting that which the public wants, and to a certain degree, there's truth in that. On the other hand, if we are at all positive and optimistic about our society, if we believe that the levels of taste and levels of political informed polity can be raised, then every element of society has a responsibility not only to pander, but to inform. And to the fact that there may be a great deal of political illiteracy out there, it's simply a challenge, ought to be a challenge to the press to do a better job of providing background, providing depth, providing the kind of substantial information which a community requires. All of us were concerned during the summer of 1982 by the way in which the press covered the Israel's invasion of the Lebanon. Reading one of the many analyses which have since come out of the press coverage, I came across this comment by a man named Don Bobley, who is a older man who is part of when he's called up by the Israel Defense Force, has responsibility of escorting news personalities, news people around to the places that they wish to go. And he's had this responsibility during several of Israel's wars. And when he was interviewed as to what happened, why this feeling that the war had been so badly covered, he said this: "What I noticed in this war, which I hadn't noticed in the Yom Kippur War, was a total lack of intellectual curiosity on the part of the reporters. They chased after blood, guts, and destruction." And I think this has become increasingly true as the television cameras and the television crews have gone into the news business. Because unlike the reporters, many of whom are stationed in a given area and some of whom have a great deal of real information about the complex political realities of a particular place, these television crews and the reporters know very little. They have very little information, most of them, to go on. They hardly know the place that they're being sent until they receive the ticket to go there. And what they need is something which is called a photo opportunity. An image which will be unforgettable, an image which will be sensational. And these images always are on the surface of events, never in the depths of the event. And so, for instance, these last weeks, as the various elements in the PLO have been fighting with one another in and near Tripoli, what we've seen day after day is a picture of a mother carrying an injured child, of a little boy carrying an injured child, of weeping small children. Now, these are human interests. Stories. I'm sure that these children are endangered, and many of them have been killed in this civil war between elements of the PLO. But these images do not tell us a great deal of what is at issue and why the struggle is taking place, nor do they inform us as to the concerns of all the parties who are involved in that particular issue. And because of this kind of the need to get the largest possible audience that can be garnered, to read a particular story, to buy a particular newspaper, to turn on a particular news program, we've had an increasing pressure in the media to present what can be presented quickly, simply, and as sensationally as possible, with as much blood and destruction and gore as can be produced in the newspapers. As I was preparing this lecture and thinking about it, I analyzed one of the morning editions of the Cleveland Plain Dealer. That particular edition ran to 48 pages. Two-thirds of these pages were devoted to advertisements and want ads and things of this type. Of the remaining pages, all but four dealt with what we would call features. They dealt with cooking, they dealt with the sports, they dealt with radio and television, they dealt with obituaries, they dealt with editorials, signed columns. They were not the news stories, which are presumably the essential purpose of a newspaper. Of the four pages that were devoted to news, slightly more than two were devoted to rape, to arson, to violence in our community, to embezzlement, to crime, to crimes of passion, to the peccadilloes of, often the sexual peccadilloes of those who are in government. That is, that less than a page and a half was devoted to the news. And of that page and a half, only one half of a page was devoted to what we call international news, news of major consequence to the world. And I found no news story which consisted of more than 12 sentences. Now, the Cleveland Plain Dealer is not one of the major newspapers of the United States. And it does not do one of the truly competent jobs of reporting either on what happened in our own city or what happens internationally. But it is not atypical of the media today. The media's bias is to appeal to the largest segment of the society possible. And because it has this bias, it is often tempted and often indulges itself in doing everything else but doing that which it claims to be its major purpose and what is in fact its essential purpose in a free society, to be our eyes and to be our ears, to get the facts and to purport the facts, and to give us as much background on our world and on its politics, economics, social problems as it possibly can. Now, there are people within the news and the media who are very serious about this function. News is often, is unfortunately criticized for the worst elements within the press. And there are many, many professionals in the media who are concerned with this responsibility to the society, who would agree with us that James Madison was absolutely on target when he said in the Federalist Papers, "A popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy, or perhaps both." People who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power that knowledge gives. And there are reporters in the television world, I think more of them in the world of the printed word, who spend their lives trying with every strength that they can to honorably, and honestly, and as thoroughly as possible report to us the facts as they can garner them. But unfortunately, this is not always the case. And the tension between those who seek the scoop, the sensational, who report only the surface events, and these more serious reporters and editors can be illustrated graphically again if we return again to the summer of 1982. As the Israeli forces move north, they move past the town of Sidon. And there, as you remember, there were innumerable reporters from all over the world who suddenly descended upon the Lebanon, eager for a story. Now, very few of these knew anything about the complexities of Lebanese politics or the ideologies of the various factions on the site. Almost none of them could speak Arabic. So all of these were limited to interviewing those who could speak English, and if they could find a European or an American on the scene, so much the better. And when they came to Sidon, they met with suddenly three doctors, two from Norway and one from Canada, who had been working in this major hospital in Sidon, PLO hospital. And here was a wonderful chance for an interview. Here were people who spoke their language, whom they could examine. And these doctors told them that the Israeli forces had strafed and bombed the hospital, that they had refused the doctor's request to allow the patients to be brought out before any military action took place. And in fact, they reported to a willing press, an eager press, that they themselves were eyewitnesses to Israel's torturing prisoners of war, the Israel Defense Force had in fact killed a number of prisoners of war before their own eyes. And this story went out on the wire services to all parts of the world. Only a few of the reporters then proceeded to go into Sidon, to enter the hospital. And when they did, they discovered that the hospital had major anti-aircraft guns on its roof, a major ammunition dump in its first floor, and that the second floor was entirely taken over by the command headquarters of one of the units of the Palestine Liberation Organization. This was reported by some, the more responsible of the press, but most had simply filed the story, and out it went. In Norway, one of the editors of the Norwegian paper, one of the Norwegian papers which did not print this material because it thought it was too sensational, decided to investigate. And they sent a reporter by the name of Friedrich Sejander to the Lebanon and to Israel. And he went to the hospital site and he interviewed the doctors. And he found as he talked to the doctors that they were quite prepared to say to him that they were ideologues of certain radical philosophies, and that they believed that the truth was whatever served their purposes, and they were totally unabashed by the fact that they might have reported what was not in fact fact, but what should have been the fact if their own purposes were being served. And he interviewed everyone that he could on the site, and he discovered that this whole story, which had been reported, this whole interview, represented a deliberate attempt by these three doctors to misinform, to distort, and to disseminate propaganda. Now, this story was widely printed in Norway. It also went out over the wires. It did not appear in most of the papers which had printed the original interview because now the Falklands were the issue, not the Lebanon, and it was no longer news. Now, Sejander and his newspaper and the editors who determined on his project represent the best in the newspaper tradition. The newspapers who printed without investigation the story of these three doctors represent a not atypical phenomenon in the newspaper world today. And one of the real tragedies of the newspaper world, in my estimation, is the fact that it tends not to be willing to give equal space, equal visibility to retractions, to reviews and revisions based on further study of stories which it has printed. Newspapers and the media tend to be very thin-skinned about criticism of the way the news is presented. And if, in fact, they are forced ultimately to print a retraction of some story, you tend to find that it will be buried on the 12th page at the bottom, whereas the original story may have appeared in the first page with a headline. And you will almost never find in the papers, you almost never see on the television or hear on the radio, a reporter say, "We have reviewed such and such a story, and the facts are not, in fact, as we reported them to you." We would all, I think, have more confidence in the press if they were far more willing to investigate themselves from time to time and report on their failings. No one can expect a responsible press to report consistently, with consistent accuracy, all the events of our complex world. There are all kinds of people and interests out there who have their own reasons to disseminate what they wish to disseminate as the truth, to disinform, to shade. It's very difficult to get a story and be confident of its accuracy. But if from time to time the media were willing to have a 60 Minutes, to have a lead column on the editorial page, which simply was a report of how a particular story had been handled and how what they have now found to be the emphasis, the facts, the background, in the way in which it should be handled, I think that the kind of built-in suspicion that has become ingrained in so many of us about the media would be to a degree dissipated. Because that ingrained suspicion, I hear it so often, "I don't believe anything I read in the newspapers," is one way of saying the newspapers cannot, the media cannot possibly perform the function in society which they must perform, and that is to inform, to disseminate the kinds of information that we need. And it's a tragedy when we cannot feel comfortable with an agency, a service, a part of our political system, which is essential to our freedoms and to our playing our role as an informed public. One of the interesting things about the press today is that to a very large degree it confronts and denies the Marxian analysis that something like the press will only serve its masters. The ultimate control of the press rests with those who control who own the press, who own the stations, with elements in our capitalist society. And according to Marxian analysis, therefore, the press ought to be a major agency in serving the interests of business. But one of the truths which has come out in study after study of business leaders is that they look upon the press largely as anti-business, as anti in their interests. So to a very large degree, the media have been able to handle the fact that they are commercially based with a degree of distance, with a degree of freedom, which is only to be commended. And it shows that in a free society, one can, in fact, transcend the interests of those who are paying the bills. One has a responsibility to one's profession, whatever it may be, which transcends the fact that one is obligated in many ways to those who control one's institution. Now, of course, there have been cases where a newspaper has reflected the personality and the peculiar interests of its owners. One thinks of the Chicago Tribune years ago, as it reflected the conservatism, the almost native isolationism of Colonel McCormick. But by and large, and to a remarkable degree, the press has maintained a certain distance from its owners and has tried as best it can to be responsible to us. Far more so, of course, than the press in any Marxist country, where the press is looked upon as a house organ of the governing bodies, and where it is permitted to print only that which is determined as acceptable by those who are in power. And one of the real tragedies of our world is that there are very few countries in our world which are willing to sustain a free press and all the turmoil and all the dissent which it inevitably builds into a society. There's only in about one country in three is there anything approaching a free press. And interestingly, over the last 10 years, there has been a serious attempt throughout the third world, I'm not now talking about the Soviet world, but the third world, not only to suppress and to control and to censor the papers and the media which are within the country, but to control and to limit the ability of reporters from outside to investigate and to report on what they see and what they find. Largely under the auspices of UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, third world countries have tried to bring into being what they call a new world order in information and communication. And by this they mean that reporters ought to be licensed, that the reporting profession ought to be defined in terms of a positive responsibility to report on the positive and constructive elements in the society, and that the license of a reporter can in fact be pulled if he investigates and becomes critical of that society. The developing societies, most of them fairly authoritarian, want law and they want order and they want calm. They don't want to be criticized. They don't want the graft, which is inevitable in any government, to be seen. They don't want opposition voices to be heard. They don't want economic failures of their economic plans to be reported. And they feel increasingly that the critical spirit that Western reporters bring to their task, to their trade, is one which they would like to limit. They would like to see that their own people and the world, if possible, hears only what they want them to hear. And so we find that they've already succeeded in the United Nations Commission on the Peaceful Use of Space to prohibit any country from using satellites to send its television programs into another country if this second country does not want to receive them. And a number of countries in Latin and South America, attempts have been made to, in fact, license reporters and to rescind the licenses of those whose reports, when filed, proved to be inimical to the interests of those who govern, which is what their perceived interests may be. I think we all agree that the greatest amount of freedom that can be accorded to the press within the limits of security should be given to them. and that a society, free society, must exert every possible effort it can in order to protect those, the right of the press to investigate, to report, and to disseminate what they have discovered. Which brings us to the immediate issue, the question of Grenada. You recall that for the first time in recent history, at least, the military did not invite a pool of reporters along with the invasion forces, and that for 3 days after the invasion, reporters were barred from entering into Grenada. Now, the military explanation of this event, which caused an immediate uproar, as given by Caspar Weinberg, the Secretary of Defense, was that he wanted to protect and was concerned about the life and the limb of the reporters. And this concern was immediately and properly laughed out of court. The military then developed another set of explanations, which have a certain degree of practical concern involved with them. They spoke of the need for success depending upon absolute security, and that if reporters suddenly disappeared from the newsroom, questions might be asked, assumptions might be made, and the surprise involved in the invasion might have been compromised. An issue of more immediate concern seems to have been the fact that, unlike, let's say, the Second World War, which was global, where a few correspondents and a few cameramen accompanied the troops in every major undertaking, today, when an invasion, some action takes place, a horde of reporters descends within hours from their jets, and they present a logistic problem, a problem of security, of numbers, quite unlike anything which has been seen before. I'm told that on the second day of the invasion, there was one reporter in Barbados trying desperately to get into Grenada for every 5 U.S. military personnel on the island. There are these, then, very practical issues which the military claim to have been the basis for their decision. But what really seems to have happened is that the White House abdicated a responsibility to the military which it ought not to have done. This White House seems to prefer to govern than to administer. And rather than to do what is required in a society like ours, that is to exert ultimate control over the military in all crucial aspects, it abdicated the decision on whether or not to, and how to handle the media to the military. And the military are trained to order and to authority. A group of reporters, obviously, are there to question. They are disturbance in a sense. And since Vietnam, there's been a kind of built-in animosity between the military and the media. The military believing that the media, in a sense, undid much of what it was trying to accomplish in South Vietnam, in Cambodia. The military will always choose to exclude. It makes things easier. And the White House did not exert, in this case, the kind of oversight which a civilian government must, in fact, engage in. But this apart, I think that the decision was a foolish one. It made an undertaking which could be defended upon on many levels suspect. It brought out all of the nightmare images of those who delight in conspiracy theories. It was not unlike the decision and the unfortunate decision made by the Israelis in the summer of 1982 to exclude reporters from going with the Israel Defense Forces into Lebanon during the first few days of that invasion, which accomplished very little except that the reporters all descended on Beirut. And for the first few days, all the information that was coming out of the PLO, of other sources, and there was nothing from Israel except the fact that Israel was preventing the reporters from getting to the site for some unknown and therefore suspect reason. All this being true, nevertheless, I think the press must ask itself a very difficult question. A question they've not yet posed, I believe. Why is it that in the last 18 months, 3 of the countries of the world who are fiercest in their support of the freedom of the press, Israel and the Lebanon, the United States and Grenada,
the British, and the issue of the Falkland Islands. Why it is, in the last 18 months, these three freedom-loving countries have each seen fit to impose severe restrictions, censorship, upon the press. Now, the press will answer that all three governments involved are conservative, right-wing governments, that they are extraordinarily security conscious, that they are indifferent to the interests of the free press. I do not believe that this is the case. Those who have tended to make this argument in the United States have pointed to a number of instances in which the Reagan administration has in fact limited access of information to the public under the Freedom of Information Act. They have said that agencies and groups must now pay for such information. They have said that the administrators need not take the right of the public to know in making their decisions as to whether something is classified or not. The question is simply one of security. This administration has done a number of very foolish things in the area, for instance, of insisting that certain films that come from abroad be limited as headlined when they are shown as political propaganda, films which are ecological in nature, which have nothing really to do with the major political concerns. Which, and all this assumes, of course, that we have not the ability to ourselves be critical to determine what is propaganda and what is not. This administration has very foolishly refused visas to a number of people whose politics they disapprove of. The widow of Allende from Chile, Ian Paisley, the radical Protestant leader from Ireland, a number of spokesmen for the Irish Republican Army. Perhaps the most unfortunate act in this respect by this administration has been a plan which they have announced to require all senior officials of the government who write on their years in office or write on politics after they leave the government to submit their writings to some kind of pre-publication censorship on the grounds that there may be implicit in it information which they've garnered one way or another which is still classified, even though much of this information may in fact be already long known in the public domain. Now, these actions are foolish, they are unnecessary, they are ineffective. But interestingly, many of those who have written about the attitudes of the Reagan administration towards security and secrecy, including those who some were most passionate in their attack on the decision involving the exclusion of the press from Lebanon, have said that in respect to these areas, this administration has been somewhat better than the two administrations which preceded it. In a bitter editorial which appeared in Time magazine, the senior editor of Time, for instance, wrote, and this editorial had to do with the exclusion of the press from Grenada, this administration has been far more intelligent and helpful in dealing with the press than was customary during the Nixon age of paranoia and the Carter era of petty meanness. So I don't think one can simply put down the concerns of three freedom-concerned governments to the activities of the press to the fact that it is right that these governments tend to be right-wing, that they tend to have security concerns, or that the press tends not to agree with the politics of those three governments. What seems to be at issue is a combination of factors. Some of them I've already alluded to, they're very practical. When David Brinkley appeared before a Senate committee after the Grenada incident, along with a number of other senior columnists and representatives of the media, Brinkley said, American reporters and cameramen have accompanied the American forces in all previous military actions, including D-Day in this war. They have been willing to sign documents that they assume responsibility for their own safety, that they will not hold the government guilty in any way if they are harmed or maimed or killed. And they have been willing to abide by the rules of secrecy which have been imposed by the military. He did not, however, analyze the differences in kind which have come into being between, let's say, the Second World War and the events of the last year or two. In the first instance, the Second World War was global. Grenada is a small island, Lebanon is a small country, The Falklands are a small chain of islands. Whereas during the Second World War, you had a sprinkling of correspondence across the globe. Now, within hours, you have a horde of correspondence concentrating on a small area. It's a very different problem for the military. And whereas during the Second World War, there was general, rather massive agreement with the purpose of the Allies among the reporters who accompanied the troops, there are today in the West great differences, ideological and political, among reporters as among all citizens, as to the best way in which foreign policy should be conducted. And there is, particularly in Europe, a tradition that papers are owned by parties, that they reflect the party ideology, and newspaper columnists and reporters are sent out to find those facts which will fit in to the particular position that the party takes, whether it be right or left or center, rather than to simply critically report the facts as they find them. And among American reporters, there's been increasing pressure simply to get the photo opportunity, to do the sensational, to report back on somebody from one's hometown, rather than to really do the kind of serious reporting which we talk about when we're seriously discussing the responsibilities of the media. The media have also, I believe, and I think this is the real nub of the problem, the media have increasingly in the last years, the best of them, become guilty of a sin of which clergymen are uniquely aware. And that is the ability to criticize what one sees, one's community, the actions of others, without being responsible for having responsibility for the consequences of the decisions that those people are making. I believe that almost unconsciously, ever since Watergate in Vietnam, the press has developed a certain self-righteousness, a certain sense of hubris. It has sensed its power. And the press is terribly, terribly powerful. Make no mistake about it. The press have easier access to the leaders of our government than many of their own subordinates. They have easier access to our elected representatives than many of us may have. There isn't an agency of the government which doesn't have elaborate quarters for the press. They want to use the press, and in turn, they are used by the press. The senior leaders of the press are today among the best paid and most powerful individuals in our country. And the press has a role which is crucial in determining what will be the major political issues of the day, how we will view the major political figures of the day, what will be the agenda of national policy during the day. The issues they chose to splash across page one and to investigate become issues. The issues which they choose to not to investigate, not to emphasize, become of lesser concern. That's inevitable. But the press is powerful, very powerful, necessarily so. And the press has begun to sense its own power, to be self-conscious about its power, about its ability as the fourth estate to affect the course of events. And it's begun to unconsciously, perhaps consciously, want to, in fact, change the course of events. We saw the first emergence of this in America as the press began in the late 60s and early 70s to justify what was called advocacy reporting, which is to say that since there is no total impartiality, why not simply be open and candid about it and admit, though, without signing the article, that one was writing what one felt, one was writing using the adjectives which encouraged others to agree with one's position, one was omitting what did not fit one's particular argument, one's particular philosophy. A man named Michael Ledeen is an instructor at the Georgetown School for International Strategic Studies. In an article on the press, which I read recently, he reports a conversation he had with a senior television journalist during the war in Lebanon. And according to Ledeen, the conversation went this way. Television journalist, how can Begin and Sharon continue to bomb Beirut after all the pictures that we've put on television? Ledeen, well, you know, there are other issues besides that of public relations which must be of concern to Jerusalem. Television journalist, but we've seen to it that these pictures are sent all over the world. Now, what's implicit in this kind of conversation? What's implicit is that what we are doing is not simply reporting to a public back home so that it can make its own mind up as to its feelings and what ought to be its judgment of a particular activity by another government, but that in fact we can pressure that government to do what we, the press, believe ought to be done, in this case to stop the bombing, by the way in which we disseminate, we emphasize, we broadcast the news. Now, inevitably, in any corporation, in any estate, there develops a consensus as about what ought to be and how things ought to be. And since the media reports and reports critically, that's its mission. And since it is not held responsible for administrating a decision, carrying it out after it is in fact in place, it is easy to criticize. It is easy to overlook the practical concerns, all the contradictions of politics, all the contradictions of human personality. And it's easy, really, in a sense, what I'm saying, it's easy to become preachy. It's easy to know what needs to be done and to demand that everything live up to that particular standard. And thus, when one has an absolute standard, a standard of what is right, all that does not conform it with it is then challenged, is then questioned, is then held up for either mockery or sarcasm or simply for ridicule. What I'm suggesting, and I may be very wrong, what I'm suggesting is I've sensed in the press in recent years a feeling that there is a way in which foreign policy and international relations ought to be conducted, that somehow the way in which our world conducts foreign policy is wrong. It results in death, war, and that all activity which is somehow military, all activity which does not conform with the highest aspirations of the human race, which we all share, is to be criticized, is to be held up for severe judgment. And that the press itself can play a major role in changing the way in which the world goes about the business of government and the relationships between governments. Now, this sense that the Fourth Estate can play a major role on its own in the governance of the United States, the governance of our communities, and the relationships of the world is, I think, a very dangerous thing. The press is to be a media through which we make up our minds. Now, the press obviously is part of the body politic. But the self-conscious sense that it can affect on its own how things are perceived will lead it ultimately to become an agency for, perhaps unconsciously, to propagandize its own view of the world. And its own view of the world is one which does not bear a degree of responsibility commensurate with its power. It reports and then moves on to the next story. It goes to the Falklands and then to Grenada and then to Nicaragua. This is a danger, and I think a major one. I don't know quite how one can get one's hand on the sense that the press will pull back from the sense of its own power, this hubris. I know that on Yom Kippur, for a rabbi goes out to conduct services, or whoever is to lead the service, we are told by our tradition to recite a prayer which begins, Hine ani mimas. You know, I am really inadequate to the task which I am about to undertake. That sense of humility is one which I find missing in the press today. Example. After Grenada, the Defense Department, under pressure, announced that there would be a commission which would consist of people from the media and people from the Defense Department, people from the administration, to discuss, to determine how on some real issues. Newsweek handled last week this story this way. Though unchastened by criticisms of press curbs during the Grenada invasion, the Pentagon last week pledged to form a commission to review the restrictions and to suggest rules for coverage of future military activity. The panel, to include both military and journalists, will be headed by retired Major General Seidel, who spent two difficult years as chief American military spokesman in Vietnam. Seidel, now a director of public relations for Martin Marietta Corporation, had the unenviable task conveying to a skeptical press General Westmoreland's promises of an early victory. He was not a fount of information, but says former CBS Saigon Bureau Chief Ed Phuy, he escaped with his integrity, which is saying a lot for that time and place. It remains to be seen whether Seidel's new boss, President Reagan, will give him more latitude than Westmoreland did. Instead of saying there's a problem, there's an attempt to resolve it, it's a serious attempt, every adjective is loaded. Every statement here is cynical and skeptical. It is a form of hubris. It is an unwillingness to admit that there may be, in fact, issues which ought to be investigated. There may, in fact, have been some reasons which led to the decisions, and these reasons cannot be passed off without thought. I have a feeling that it might be very wise for the press if they would come together, because they are a corporation, and appoint on their own a national commission of a few senior retired press people whose job it would be year in and year out to review the media's handling of the news and to publish reports that were, in fact, critical analyses of how the news was handled. The real problem, I think, is that of all the elements which are part of the body politic, the press is the only one that escapes critical review. There is no national body, there is no commission, there is no way in which the public can, in fact, review. There are, from time to time, reporters who will analyze a particular newspaper. There are reports on particular events. But there is no ongoing body charged with the review, with an analysis of the state of the press in the United States. Now, that review could be very positive. There are many ways in which it could report on the accomplishments of the press. It could be a watchdog signaling to us when there are dangers to the freedom which the press must enjoy. But it could also be it would also be useful if those who know how the news is handled and have proven over a lifetime their competence, their professionalism, if from time to time they would publish critical reviews for us, which would help us understand a very complex issue and which would hold the press accountable to its own. Doctors in a hospital are now held up by their peers to review of surgery, to review of the way in which they conduct their professional business. Most professions have some kind of professional board of review. The press does not. The best of the newspapers have sometimes an ombudsman inside who will review one or another matter, but his job is more complex than that. And what is discovered is often not published. All of us need to have confidence in a free press. That's what I'm saying. And the press has to reassure us, not only that it's doing its task, but that it's doing its task honorably and honestly. And just as the press is suspicious of government agencies who announce that they are going to create an internal committee to investigate some assumed failure by that department, so we are naturally suspicious of the way in which the press goes about regulating itself. Some means, whatever it be, I think, has to be found to reassure us that the press is doing what we hope it should do. Some means must be found to make the press recognize that it will be held to account by its own. It will, I think, encourage the standards, raise the standards of the press, and do more importantly, allow us to read the press with less cynicism and less skepticism, and therefore derive from it the news, the information, the sense that we can now honestly make a judgment on a particular issue. Amen.